You're listening to Auto D, coming at you live.
Yes, which way, what, when, how? Mr. Auto D, flip the track right now.
Hey, I'm Auto D. Thanks for tuning in. We're going to listen to some great music and talk to some really cool people. And I know there's a lot of things you could be doing, so I appreciate that you're getting with this. Hey everybody, thanks for tuning in. I am your host, Otto Doniolo, and tonight my guest is KSLX Classic Rock Drive Time DJ, Pete Cummings. Oh, did I mention he's a killer drummer? Let's kick things off with a track from the Mowgli. Like a little tune that starts with the drums to introduce my guest today, Pete Cummings, super drummer and local rock DJ. Pete, how are you doing?
I'm well, thank you kindly for such a gracious intro. I'm not sure I can live up to that billing, and I see you've gotten to your D list now for guests, so thank you for having me.
My D list. No. You're on the A list, man. My A list is just really broad.
That's good. Well, that's because you're so seasoned and everyone knows you.
That's what I'm sure that's what it is. Well, listen, what's up with you these days? Tell people what's going on.
Well, I'm fortunately still in my ninth year at KSLX, which has been great. I've been around the dial a little bit, but largely within the same company. And we were recently purchased, which I think a lot of people might know, by a company out of the Minneapolis-St. Paul area called Hubbard Broadcasting. And they're actually going to be moving us all into the same building next year, which is
Holy
interesting.
Cow.
When there used to be such rivalries between the stations, and they were heated back in the day. You know, you would have promotions staff like when competing stations would show up at concerts, sometimes would, you know, take all their radio station stickers and plaster the opposing vehicles, you know, for the promotional vehicles for the other station. And, you know, it used to be heated, but now we're going to have to all play together.
How, do you think that's going to go well?
I do think so. It's especially seeing as, you know, there's 93.3 Alt AZ now. So right. There isn't as much overlap between the three stations as there had been in the past. And that's what the parent company was all about. They were, you know, saying that this seemed like a smart move. There has not been a viable signal in the market for several years with that particular format, and they thought it was time to do it. And so that almost has diffused a little bit, so we're all going to act like Switzerland and the Holy See and, you know, just be neutral and all get along. But I think it's going to be great because I got a lot of friends at all the other stations simply because I've just worked at them over the years. And so it'll be neat to just get everybody in the same building. I think it'll go well.
Yeah, I think the change should be refreshing, really, just for the new space as well.
Yeah, and they are going to you know, build out from the ground up, and everything's going to be brand new.
When do you think the move is going to happen?
I think they're hoping for May of next year. They're probably going to move us one at a time. So obviously, you know, we're all wondering who's going to get the first move.
Oh, okay. So first station on the first floor, kind of get things operating.
We'll all be kind of, there'll be like sales on one floor, but all the studios will be on the same floor. But okay. I think we'll each have our own
spaces. Well, as long as they never change formats and start competing, you'll be fine.
Exactly. Yeah. We'll be in the same building. There'll be a lot of, you know, pencil throwing and nasty emailing if they ever change format again.
But well, it sounds like it'll be a good thing.
Yeah, it absolutely will be.
Well, when you do that, you know, that's going to be, let's see, you said 7 years now you've been at KSLX?
In my ninth
year?
Yep, 2007.
And you've been doing radio in the Valley since 93?
Yeah, since 92, 93. Yeah, okay. Almost, 21 years? 23
All right,
years.
Well, let's go back to how in the world you got into radio. I remember I came from a little town, Peoria, Illinois, 100,000, 130,000 people, right?
Little for Phoenix, yeah.
Yeah, it was Phoenix grows about that much every year.
Right.
And Peoria hasn't grown in the 25 years I've been here. It's the same size it was. You know, some people come, some people leave. But I remember a couple of friends who went into radio, and I thought, gosh, why would you do that, you know?
Because we hate ourselves. That's why. That's the only reason to go into radio. Yeah.
But now doing a bit of this, it's like, oh my gosh, this would have been the bomb to be in radio the whole time.
Yeah, and it was. But I feel like I should have been born about 10 years earlier because I really missed, you know, the true heyday. Because when I started at KUPD back in the early 90s, I was interning before I got on the air part time. But I heard all the glory days about when KUPD was a double wide down by the freeway, and, you know, and stories about there being, you know, twin blenders on a counter in one of the production rooms firing up margaritas. And, you know, they had razor blades and radio stations back in those days to cut tape. Now, apparently that was the ruse behind the radio station having razor blades.
Even at recording studios, we used to make the you know, the tape reels to send out to radio, like for station IDs by the artists.
Oh, yeah.
And you'd just cut those and record those and record those and cut them.
Put them in those little boxes and ship them off.
Man, that was so much work. Just so you could say hello on the radio station with your favorite DJ.
Exactly. But yeah, I started interning while I was going to ASU, and I just got lucky, got on the air there. And
what was your major at ASU?
Naturally, broadcasting. Although, silly me, broadcast station management.
That'll never happen.
The only time I'm in the station manager's office is if I'm in trouble or accruing another fine.
I doubt that. But so you graduated in 92 then or 93?
December of 93 and was already
on the air. You were already at KUPD.
Yeah, I was doing part-time. I was doing the local show. And the funny way in was I was interning for Curtis Johnson, who was the program director at the time. And Larry Mack was a guy who was there. And he was my in. He was the assistant music director. And he let me sit in Saturday nights when he was on the air. Mm-hmm. And I started learning then, you know, back when they still used CDs and card files and it wasn't all on computer still. And I was able to intern for Curtis, and then Larry went over with a couple other people. Some people who have been in town a while will remember there was a Z-Rock in town for a while. A flagship station was in Dallas, and so Larry went over there, but it was common knowledge in the corridors of KUPD that I did an impression of Larry. And so the promotions chick, the Monday after the weekend when they quit and went to Z-Rock, promotions gal poked her head in the door with Curtis, and she said, "Hey, Kurt, why don't we have Pete act like he's Larry and have him do the local show tonight, and then we'll act like nothing ever happened." And then Kurt thought about it for a minute. He goes, "No, that's a great idea." He goes, "Pete, why don't you guest host the local show tonight and just go to the closet? You know, you can go pick out four bands." He goes, "You can even play your band." So the cool thing was, the first time I was actually a DJ on the air in Phoenix, Arizona, the first song I played on the air was my band.
That's awesome.
So that was a kind of funny story. And then I've just, been, largely for many years, Sandusky's whipping boy for years and years between KUPD, KDKB, and now KSLX. But it's been a fun ride.
Yeah, you were in Sedona for a couple of years, KAZM.
KAZM. You guys might remember the sitcom Alice from the 70s, right. That had Mel's Diner. Mm-hmm. And you remember Mel, Vic Tabak?
Mm-hmm.
His brother, Joe Tabak, started KAZM in Sedona. So okay. I worked for, Mel from Mel's Diner's nephew up there. And it was a great building to work in if your last name was Tabak. But, I lasted there for a while. Unfortunately, got a call and was able to come back to work in Phoenix.
And you came back to KDKB.
Yep, I did that in 2000. And weird hire date, September 11th, 2000, 1 year prior. And so, in addition to being a new world in radio for me, all of a sudden the world became a new place a year later, for sure.
Yeah, that's the truth.
But then I got my old job at afternoons. I was doing nights at KDKB, and then I got the call to get afternoons back at KUPD and did that for a couple of years before the disastrous morning show experience over at KDKB, which was no one in specific's fault, probably as much as my own as anyone else in the building, but it was an interesting experiment. And
and that was your first morning?
That was the first morning show, and we just didn't have the right everything.
So fill me in. What's weird about what my experience with radio is, when as an engineer producer guy, I tended to listen to music that related to records I was working at the time. So I might be doing a rock record, and then an R&B client comes in, and that record generates more R&B clients, and all of a sudden for 2 years you're not listening to rock radio because you don't have any rock and roll clients or projects. And so I missed stuff sometimes that happened. So tell me about this morning meltdown.
Oh man. Well, it was, I had a partner, and it all stems from, and probably like you, a lot of your best friends and coolest people in the world that you know are musicians. And it's always been that way for me as well. I really have an affinity for people that have a musical sense. And for some reason, I always click with those people. And so I had this great friend of mine, a bass player named Mike, and we had a great rapport. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, as our program director pointed out, 6 months into the Sputnik experiment here, he said, "You guys are great in a room." And then didn't finish the sentence. Like, oh, all right. And, unfortunately, he got canned shortly thereafter. And then my partner got canned. And just, they were very impatient because we were coming in after, Tim and Mark, who had been there for years and years.
Right.
Heritage morning show. Right. Guys were awesome. They did an incredible job. They had thousands and thousands of people that just loved waking up with them every morning. And now the delicious irony being that I now work with Mark. He is our one half of our morning show now at KSLX. So,
oh, cool.
It's neat the way things come full circle. Even though it's a metro area of, 4 million, 4 and change now.
Right.
Pretty small pool in radio. Eventually, even though some of the best light can come from burning bridges, it's never the best idea in this business.
Yeah, I hear you. And in this business, you have had an opportunity to interview a ton of people. You have crossed paths with lots of folks. And I know you're going to run out tonight to the Van Halen show. We were talking earlier. And on the list of people that you've interviewed, you have listed Eddie Van Halen. So you had an opportunity to interview him?
Yeah. And, I got to tell you, I like to fancy myself as a true professional in every position that I've been placed. But I was such a huge Van Halen fan growing up. One of my favorite bands. When I discovered them, it was like a watershed moment when I heard Van Halen 1. I was like, what is this? Who are these guys?
And so I was driving to band practice and had put the first record in. It was like, wow.
Yeah, you're like, what is this? Yeah. And so, the culmination of all my years of fandom of the band, loving them growing up in this little town in Brattleboro, Vermont, thinking, maybe someday, And here I am holding the microphone, holding the broadcasting equipment that is going to that's going to take my voice and Eddie Van Halen's voice back to the studio to broadcast a 100,000-watt signal, and the gravity of that set in. And then I look down the hallway, and there's Ed in the suspenders outfit with the Frankenstrat on, noodling, warming up, and walking right towards me. And I had that moment, and that was one of the only interviews where I was slightly starstruck, and I just did not come off real well. And I'm sure Ed was kind of like, all right, whatever, dude, I got to go warm up. But it was an incredible opportunity, to meet Ed. And we did a meet and greet a couple of years earlier. This was the Gary Cherone tour that I got the chance to do this when they were over at Auction Pavilion, which obviously where the show is tonight. And but yeah, it wasn't my best interview. But I've done better interviews with David Lee Roth and Sammy Hagar and stuff. And but I really idolized being a drummer. I idolized Alex. And mm-hmm. the only interaction I ever had with Alex was the Balance tour in '95. I was had there with my my ex wife at the time, and we were doing the cattle call photo shoot. And I stood right next to Alex, and then after the picture was taken, they heard you right back out. But Alex grabs my attention, he grabs my arm, and he motions to my wife at the time, and he goes, "Hey, is she with you?" I go, "Yeah." He goes, "Hey, rock it for me." Rock it for you. Okay, Alex, I suppose. So I have waited, you know, the culmination of my fandom of Van Halen culminates to that moment with Alex Van Halen saying, that one's getting away, but you go for it, buddy.
And you still like musicians.
Yeah. Well, what can I say? We're a rare breed. But right. But yeah, it was really neat to finally get to that point when you're like, oh my God, maybe I've proven my dad wrong. I did finally get to the point I wanted to get to, you know, and here I am talking to Van Halen. And it's
well, as a drummer, you actually have had an opportunity now, maybe mostly through the station and those affiliations, but you've opened for a lot of these guys.
Yeah, we've had the privilege. Matter of fact, for Arizona Bike Week this past spring, my band opened for Ted Nugent. We were the direct support.
Band would be called the Pete Cummings Band.
The Pete Cummings Band. Yes, we did. And then the neat thing is we did this in July of last year when the Motley Crue Alice Cooper tour was rolling through, and they're on a very long farewell tour right now, final tour, and. Mm-hmm. They're going to be in town December 19th, that Saturday before Christmas, and they're going to be at U.S. Airways Center downtown. I don't know if the naming rights change has kicked in yet. I still call it U.S. Airways Center. But and then there's the official after party at Cooperstown across the street, and we are the house band.
Oh, cool.
Last year, Alice and his band got up, and they played after us. So I can't say they're going to do that again this year, but seeing as it's probably the official after party, there's a chance that may happen. And because it's so close and it's logistically easy, there is even a chance that maybe Motley Crue may show up. So we'll
cool.
see. So yeah, so those kind of opportunities are just fantastic and really validating when you know you put in the years of hard work trying to become a better player and stuff.
And well, and as a drummer, I mean, I'm looking at your photos on Facebook, and you know, sometimes taken from the stage out over this vast audience, and I think anybody who's performer who comes up as a kid playing in clubs just dreams of being on that big stage in front of all those people.
Yeah.
So I mean, that's a dream come true anyway you look at it.
Truly.
And you know, my I've cheated that experience on my side. I get to wear a wig and play in front of a bunch of people,
right,
doing the Lennon show, and all these people are out there having an experience, and I'm like, wow, they love me. And it's like, no, if I take my wig off, they'd all get up and walk out, you know.
Get that Steve Miller factor. Guy's got hits all over the radio, all over the world, but you would not recognize him walking down the street.
So it's kind of funny doing a Lennon show, you know, it's not real. It's
right.
Like, it's a double fantasy. They're having one fantasy and I'm having another. I'm up there and thinking I'm a star.
And then who knew that the tribute band thing was going to become so huge?
Yeah, pretty incredible that it's so successful.
Yep.
You know, we talked earlier, I've got a big show coming up on John's birthday involving a bunch of people down at Celebrity Theater. And it's amazing. That's a 2,600 seat theater, and we're being told to expect it to be sold out.
Yeah, it's fantastic. You know, there's still a lot of fans of the Beatles, and you know, I will always look back at, you know, 1950 to 2000 is quite possibly the watershed moment for popular music, at least for rock. You know, being a mm-hmm. rock guy, I love drums, I love guitar, always will, and I like that to be a part of a lot of the music that I enjoy. And it just feels like, you know, that era of great music is slipping farther into the rear view. There's still great music
getting
being
old. It means you're
I know that's
old.
Exactly what that is the moment where I've realized that I need to buy a sports car and
well, it's
start a Ashley Madison account.
No, I think those are the wrong answers.
Wait, is that over?
The wrong solutions.
Did something happen to that?
But no, you know, when you spend your day listening and working at classic rock, you really are reinforcing the stuff you already love. You're getting a real appetite of that. And radio, for like new music radio, seems to be far more fragmented than it was. And I think you'll find stuff you love if you just got to find out where to find it.
You do. And I'm lazy about searching out new music. I think you get to a point, you know, where, you know, familiarity is it's almost like a comfortable jacket or something like that.
Right.
Music you recognize and you resonate with that has had great memories.
See,
for you.
You like some really heavy stuff, and you also like some more pop stuff. You're probably familiar with Porcupine Tree.
Yes.
And Earl Greyhound, maybe.
Earl Greyhound, no.
New York-based trio. You'd love them.
I bet I would.
So these are, you know, there's a lot of bands out there that we don't see on the radio. We don't necessarily see big time in American venues, but
A band my wife just turned me on to recently from my home state of Vermont that I was unaware of, a band called Dispatch. You ever heard of these guys?
No.
They're a trio, and they'll play different instruments. They'll switch during the show, and then the other guy will get behind the drums. But their music's fantastic. They're a great band, Dispatch.
And then speaking of music, I would say that there must have been some songs in your early days that kind of turned you on and got you pointed this way.
Yeah, I would say...
You started playing drums when you were like 5 years old?
Well, I started piano originally and then naturally got lazy and realized, hey, drums are fantastic. You don't have to worry about what key you're in or hitting the wrong note or anything like that. And so it became easy. Piano for about 10 years, but at least I got some musical theory established and then just kind of switched to drums. And, you know, I'm not an incredible player, but I can keep a beat. But I've just been afforded some neat opportunities that have allowed me to continue pursuing it. So
back in the day, what are a couple of tunes that really got you going?
I would say my mom took my sister and I on a long road trip to Wisconsin when I was a little kid, and the only artist, at least for my Puritan conservative parents, could tolerate at the time was like Billy Joel. Was about as wild as they got. So I got turned on to some Billy Joel, like the Stranger album and Piano Man, and you know, first time I heard Captain Jack, I was like, all right, that's pretty cool. I dig that song. That's all right. What do those lyrics say? And I made the embarrassing request of my mother, though. He has a song called The Entertainer on, I think, Street Life Serenade. And one of the lyrics is, played all kinds of palaces, laid all kinds of girls. Naturally, the inquisitive young mind wanted to know, Mom, what does laid girls mean? Actually asked that of my mother, but at least she dug. But she hated the car peeling out at the end of Moving Out.
Well, come on, though. Did she give you an answer? You don't remember that part?
I think
her horrified look on her face.
Yeah,
told you
after
all
the
you
beating stopped, I don't remember much after that. But yeah, you know, some of the early Billy Joel, like Moving Out, and you know, anything.
You were a Stones fan too, coming up.
Big Stone, yeah. I had the big picture posters of Mick Jagger and Keith Richards, and it was when I first heard "Start Me Up." I was like, oh, I love that guitar tone. And even though that was actually from a much earlier time in the Stones' career when they first started writing that, it was supposed to be a reggae tune originally, but I just loved that sound. That song, it just was infectious, and I actually wanted to get a copy of it, so I went down the local record store and accidentally bought Still Life. And I couldn't understand why the version was live and it wasn't the one I heard on the radio. I was like, damn it. So then I had to go back out and buy Tattoo You.
That's funny.
But yeah, the Stones were definitely huge in steering me in that direction. The first time I heard Sympathy for the Devil and the live version of Gimme Shelter and Midnight Rambler and, you know, and Beggar's Banquet and Let It Bleed and all the old Stone stuff, I was like, man, I really resonated with that. I was definitely more of a Stones guy than a Beatles guy. It seems, you know, you always land in one camp or the other, but just something about the Stones, they worked for me. I loved them.
Cool. Well, let's play a little Stones. Let's do a little Start Me Up in memory of those days.
Absolutely.
You're listening to Auto D, coming at you live.
And I am your host, Otto Daniolo, here with my guest, Pete Cummings, rock drummer and radio DJ. And Pete, we've been talking a bit about your radio career, a little bit about some of the people you've had an opportunity to interview, and also a bit about performance. But I noticed on your list of interview credits, there are a handful of TV people, Patrick Swayze, Dan Aykroyd, Kate Hudson, Bob Saget, and Dick Cavett. So I just wondered, any interesting stories there?
Yeah, you know, when I did the morning show in 2005, my partner, who was the producer for Tim and Mark, he had a lot of contacts in with a lot of, you know, press agencies and such. And so we got on the junket for a lot of the, you know, interviews when you get Hollywood people promoting their movie or their album or whatever. You know, they go on with, you know, a million morning shows in 1 4-hour span one morning, and, you know, oftentimes if you're lower on the totem pole, you get them at the tail end of that, you know, which can make for some interesting interviews. But I really enjoyed interviewing Dick Cavett, who was this television host, you know, back in the 60s and 70s. And but he was, you know, even though he seemed like almost like a William F. Buckley type, all the musicians respected him and went on his shows, and like Jimi Hendrix and, you know, and Jefferson Airplane and Janis Joplin and all these artists would go on with him. And he told me a couple of fantastic stories. One of them, it's just neat to hear a firsthand story from somebody who knew Janis Joplin. And he said he told me about the time that he took Janis Joplin to see Easy Rider when it premiered in a theater in New York City in Times Square. And the way he described it was so funny. He's like, so we were sitting there in the theater, and the lights had gone down. And at one point, I heard a little gluck, 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 which led me to believe there was a problem with the plumbing in the theater. But it turns out it was the sound of a pint of Southern Comfort being poured into a paper cup next to me. He said it didn't seem to affect her, you know. But yeah, he went to Easy Rider with Janis Joplin. That's while she drank awesome. A pint of SoCo watching Easy Rider. And then I was also a huge fan of Groucho Marx, still am, just for his wit, you know. Mm-hmm. And because, you know, back then you had to be clean or at least over, you know, people's heads with some of your innuendo. Mm-hmm. And he told me this really funny story about there was a time, I guess, in the 50s when psychics were really huge in Hollywood. So all these, you know, Hollywood elite would go to these seances or whatever. And so Dick and Groucho had been invited to this one seance, you know. And so Dick was trying to, you know, prep Groucho for this experience and say, like, now, Groucho, you have to be a little bit more reverential there because these people are there to speak to their dead relatives. So we just have to be a little reserved.
Wanted to bite his tongue.
Huh? Yeah, yeah. Bite your tongue, Groucho. So they get there and they get, you know, and it's just like the hokey Hollywood scene that you would expect it is, you know, the dimmed room with the crystal ball on the black velvet-covered table, and the medium's got her stupid turban on and, you know, the long fingernails. I am now in contact with the spirit world. Does anyone here have a question? And Groucho pipes up, goes, yeah, what's the capital of North Dakota? you know, to be able to have been put in a position where I get to interview this guy and hear this story about somebody that I've only read about and seen, you know, ancient TV shows from, it's just another validation that has really been really rewarding to get to be able to have that story under my belt and stuff. And yeah, Dick was a fantastic guest, and it was only on the phone. I wish I could have met him in person. But
who do you look forward to interviewing one day?
Gosh, you know, the interviews have, in afternoons, you know, with shortened attention spans, you know, I don't talk a lot, at least on my show, just because, you know, the music is king and the music is the most important thing. And
you know, one day formats might move a little.
Yeah, who knows?
If you're in a position where you're interviewing people, I mean, who's one of the artists or one of the musicians that you do get to spin records for that you've never had an opportunity to talk with?
Yeah, you know, I wouldn't mind talking to Carlos Santana. I would love to pick his brain for a little while. Gosh, there's not too many that I always love. The couple times that I've had a chance to sit down with David Lee Roth, he was always, you know, it's just kind of just an entertaining thing. It might not even be for necessarily the content. It's just, it's like an amusement park ride. I want to get on that one again. Can I just, you know, listen to him spout off for 10 minutes just because it's, you know, always so filled with just some of the most interesting takes on language. And
well, when did you interview David Grohl? How long ago was that?
Dave Grohl was I think it was 2005. It was the year I did the morning show, and the show was at US Airways Center.
Okay.
And that was also one of my greatest moments, although the worst part is that I don't know where most of these interviews are.
Right.
I just don't know. They're gone. They're lost to the ethos. At least I have the memories. But I was interviewing Dave Grohl, and Weezer was opening, and there were a bunch of radio people lined up, but because I was the morning guy at the time, at least I was a little higher in the pecking order. And the tour guy was like, all right, everybody line up here. And he goes, okay, you. And he picked me first. I got to have the first interview with Dave Grohl. So I went in there, and I'd seen the previous tour when it was at Comerica Theater, then the Dodge Theater. And I was really tickled because the band, they're huge Rush fans as well, of course. Mm-hmm. And at one point during the show at the Dodge, they went into Rush's Cygnus X1, which is this doom, bum, ba da dum. This really, you know, complicated little thing. And he joked on stage that night that nobody knows a whole Rush song, you know. And so I mentioned that to him. And at the time, I was sporting this goofy stash and muzzy thing. And Dave was wearing a mustache at the time. So we instantly had a mustache bonding moment. And it was a really good interview. It went well, and he seemed to be genuinely enjoying himself. And the tour guy came back after everyone was done. He says, yeah, Dave said you did the best interview he's done on the tour so far. So I was like, oh, that's great, and I wish I freaking had it. But
yeah. Well, you know, it's about that time. It was about 2004, 2005, when he did the Probot record.
Yes.
And I worked on that record just a teeny piece. And it was a funny story. Well, that was a bunch of guest vocalists. I cut Max's track from Soulfly, the lead vocal, on that song that he wrote for him to sing. But here's the funny part of the story. It has nothing to do with making the record. I was married at the time. My wife handled the calendar and the books and the phone. She comes into my office and says, do you know a guy named Dave Grohl? And I was like,
Dave Grohl.
Do I know him? I was like, no, I don't know. I mean, I know who he is. And she's like, oh, well, I just thought maybe he was a friend of yours. I'm like, why? Well, because he called and he was just so nice on the phone. And I'm like, what? Yeah, he just wanted to ask. He asked some questions about the studio. He just needs a couple hours of studio time. He asked about the tape machines. It was really nice. I thought, honey, you don't even know who you're talking to. It was pretty funny.
It's one of the biggest rock stars on the planet. No big deal.
Yeah,
no
but big that's deal. Cool because that's kind of how he is and how he approaches it. He called. He called the studio.
Yeah.
You know, he booked the time. Was very polite and genuine to somebody. You know, I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to lean on his side in the Courtney Love Dave Grohl feud. I'm thinking Dave's striking me as the more sane of the two. He's the if they were both running for office, Dave would have my vote
by far, by far. Now, when you and I met was actually, what year was it? I know
that
what
was, I believe it was either 91 or 92.
Okay.
And
you were in a band called Echo House.
Yes. And it was an originals band. And of course, the singer, Neil, and I are still tight. And he's actually going to be sitting in, guesting with the Pete Cummings band for the Alice Cooper Motley Crue after
cool.
party deal. Because I, you know, we got to step up for a show like that. So I need some masterful vocals. And this guy delivers them. So. But it was an originals band, and we were bamboozled into going into the studio to record for what we thought at the time was an expectant Gordon Lightfoot, but a friend of the friend of the band, or a friend of the friends of the band, was slightly mentally deficient and had concocted this entire relationship with Gordon Lightfoot that was all in her head, and told us that, yeah, he's moving to town and he's starting a label and he wants, you know. So it was great that, you know, my first true experience in the music industry was a complete sham to prepare me for the future heartache, which
That's right.
has come my way. But it was a great opportunity because, I'll tell you to this day, as I said off mic before, and I want everyone listening to know that honestly, of all the stuff that I've done musically, that what you did with that band, you know, they always say it's the sum of part, or actually the sum should be greater than, or the product should be greater than just the sum of the parts. And that's indeed what you were able to deliver out of us for that. That was still to this day the best recording that I've been on. And I have it on cassette somewhere, and I'll have to share that with you again because you don't have it.
Yeah, I know. There was a DAT tape floating around years ago. But I remember the name of the band stuck with me, and I remember thinking that project came out really nice and tight. Like that one came off just the way you're trying to make it happen.
Exactly, yeah. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of a pop rocky kind of thing that made sense in 1991 and
exactly.
1992. And, we enjoyed some fabulous mediocrity locally as a result, as you know, and then eventually.
And look at you now.
Yeah, and now
look at me. Star of the radio world. Drive Time, KSLX.
But it was, you know, a good experience, and you know, I had some, and actually that's where it was great because in that band, that's where I met my buddy Mike, the guy who I had mm-hmm. attempted the morning show with, you know, like 13 years later. Mm-hmm. I actually moved him from Austin, Texas. He was between jobs, and it just happened to work out. But
and so now you're married. You've got how many kids? Seven?
I have a lovely little girl, Abby Rose, which you would appreciate that name, I'm sure.
Go.
Abigail Rose Cummings, but we wanted to go with Abby Rose.
That's cool.
And she's just an awesome kid, a little blondie, blonde hair, blue eyes. I had a few questions in the delivery room, but, you know, my fears were subsided good. After realizing.
So how old is she?
She is 18 months.
Okay, so she's not playing drums yet.
Well, she does love to pound on them. And the neat thing was I had a couple downstairs where she was at, and she actually knew to, when she was hitting the drums with her open hand, she knew to pull her hand away quickly so that the drum would resonate. She picked up on that already, which I thought was kind of neat. She realized how to get a better tone out of it.
Cool. Well, keep her in line, train her, you know, keep it happening.
That's right, yeah, and she's she already loves guitar. My wife is a pretty good guitar player, and she can sing, and so it's a musical household, and we always want her growing up in that, so we'll definitely encourage it. We won't push it, but we'll encourage it.
Well, you know, I run into a lot of parents who they have no clue what to do to support the kids, and then when they start to support them, they have no idea what to do to keep them kind of out of trouble. Because right. They don't know anything about this business. Luckily, you've been around it, both from a performance side and a radio side, and you know what you're getting into, or better yet, maybe what she's getting into as she grows up, if she stays in the business. So it's nice that you have that background to help protect her, try and keep her on, and you know, on paths and with people that are going to do good things for her.
Absolutely, you know? And I think she seems to have a knack for that. She likes when people are looking at her. She likes the attention, you know. So she'll be up on stage someday.
Well, listen, man, I'm going to have to let you go. I really appreciate you coming in.
It's been a
blast catching up. I know you got to run out to the concert. And I thought maybe we would spin a track from one of your favorite bands these days, which is the Foo Fighters, you told me.
Yes, absolutely.
So I picked a song.
Excellent.
And we'll spin that. So again, thanks so much, Pete.
You bet. Great to talk with you as always, Otto.
Talk to you soon. Here's Rope with the Foo Fighters.
Yeah.
listening to Auto D coming at you live. Lennon 75 is coming to the Celebrity Theater on October 9th. You really get yourself together. A mixed arts display of incredible talent on a revolving stage in celebration of John Lennon's 75th birthday. See America's foremost speed painter Randall Hedden paint the four faces of Lennon. Watch photographer David Spindell display his rare Lennon photos from the Double Fantasy recording sessions. Then enjoy one of the best Beatles bands in America, Marmalade Skies, as they set the stage for the most Lennon-like tribute artist in the biz, Otto D. from the Working Class Hero Show. Lennon 75. This is a Lennon fan bucket list event. Contact the Celebrity Theater box office for tickets at 602-267-1000 or online at celebritytheater.com.
Okay, and we do have two tickets to give away from the mailing list for the concert. So if you're listening, the winner this week is DesertLily02@yahoo.com. That's DesertLily02@yahoo.com. So if you're listening, why don't you do give us a call at 602-494-5699. That's 602-494-5699. If I can't get to the phone, certainly email me at otto@ottod.com. That's OTTO@OTTOD.com. And we'll get you set up with those. So let's move on. Tonight, normally we bring Sam Moore onto the show. And tonight, because of the anniversary of Jackie Wilson's collapse on stage 40 years ago and a personal relationship that Joyce Moore has with the story, we thought we'd bring Joyce on today. Joyce, how are you doing?
I'm here and I'm great. Otto, how are you?
I'm good. You guys had a busy week coming back from Georgia.
We had an amazing weekend. Sam was inducted into the Georgia Music Hall of Fame Saturday night. And he was amazing. He was scary. He sang so well. It was a wonderful evening. It was touching. It was poignant. We had some dear friends hanging out with us, and two of Dave Prater's children, his daughter Sharon and her daughter and husband, and then Anthony Prater and his three children came to the event. They had not been there when their dad was inducted into the Georgia Music Hall of Fame many years ago. So it was really great that we were able to have them there with us.
Cool. I saw a clip of Sam singing at the show as well. He sounded awesome.
He was, I'm telling you, he's scary. He is one scary going on 80-year-old man. You know he's going to be 80 in 2.5 weeks. So you better get ready for that show on October 12th because it's a Monday night. And we just have to be really stupid and crazy that night, I think, Otto, don't you?
Oh, absolutely. It's going to be fun. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Yep.
Well, listen, you know, we wanted to talk about Jackie Wilson, so I thought maybe I would just leave it for you to go. Fill me in a little bit on your thoughts and where this is at. I've been watching your posts on Facebook, and, you know, depending on your point of view, you would say it's interesting to alarming.
It's horrific, and I still, I can't get it out of my head. It's been 40 years tomorrow that Jack collapsed while he was singing Lonely Teardrops on the stage, headlining a Dick Clark Legends oldies show at the Latin Casino in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. And it's been 40 years that are just, it's kind of surreal and like being in the Twilight Zone.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I had a relationship with Jack in the 60s, and we remained close, we remained friends. And I remember so well the morning of the 30th of September driving from my home in, I was living in Illinois in the suburbs in Wheeling, driving into the city to my business. And somebody came on the radio and announced that Jackie Wilson had collapsed on stage at the Latin Casino the night before and that he was in a coma and they didn't think he was going to make it. And I just literally had to pull off the road. I sat and I shook. And just started screaming, no, 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 don't let this happen. He's got to be okay. He's got to be okay. And it just, I don't know that I've ever completely recovered from that.
Mm-hmm.
I wound up in December of 75, Rona Barrett, who used to be the gossip columnist and had a show, a segment every morning on Good Morning America, did a piece about Jackie and said that he was recovering, that Bobby Womack had been to see him and that he was up and he was starting to walk and he was recovering and he was in therapy and blah, blah, blah. And so I just because it was the holidays and that, I decided I was going to call the hospital and give Jackie a what for and a you know, gee, thanks a lot for scaring us all half to death.
Mm-hmm.
And when I called the hospital, found out that it wasn't true, that he was still in a coma, that there were all sorts of problems, all sorts of people making claims to basically want to take his body, and it didn't seem like anybody much cared about him. I apparently gave the head of nursing enough of a comfort level that she confided in me and asked me if she could pass my phone number to the lady that Jackie was living with and had married in a ceremony with Universal Life Church and had two children
mm-hmm.
by. And within a week or two, I heard from Lynn. And then she asked me if I could talk to her lawyer because I knew so much about certain elements of Jackie's situation. And I wound up getting subpoenaed to testify at a guardianship hearing in Cherry Hill, in Camden, New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
I went to the hospital with Lynn, kind of didn't know what to think, had never been around anybody that was in a coma. Went to the hospital with Lynn, and Jackie wasn't completely comatose at that point. He was semi-comatose, so he had fleeting, lucid moments. And I had a necklace on that had J.M. in it, and apparently the lighting behind his bed, it caught the lights.
Mm-hmm.
And it sparkled enough that all of a sudden you could see his eyes suddenly track and focus. And it was like, you know, in the cartoons where it goes doy-oy-oy-oy-oying. That's kind of what happened. And he looked at the necklace, and he recognized the necklace because the J from that necklace was the replacement J, because he had had the original one cut out of my necklace many, many years earlier, and he had it attached to a $20 gold piece that he used to wear.
Mm.
So there was something about it, and then he looked up at me, and it was, I can still see it. He had a lucid, fleeting moment. I was there, testified, did everything, went back to the hospital every day. We'd catch him, and he would have lucid moments. I promised him I would come back. That was in April of 1976. We found a therapist who had literally pulled another person, another gal by the name of Sandy, out of a coma. They had sent her down the shore to die. He got a hold of her, started working with her using patterning and proprioceptive neuromuscular facilitation, and he literally pulled her out of the coma, saved her life.
Mm-hmm.
She was viable. She got married. She was able to work. I mean, this was mm-hmm. truly a miracle, but it was a lot of hard work,
right.
And it was this brilliant physiatrist,
mm-hmm.
Dr. Richardson, who had worked with Glenn Doman, who invented patterning, which mm-hmm. is where you simulate crawling and all this stuff. So
right.
Dr. Richardson agreed to work with Jackie. And he pretty much in 2 or 3 months, Jackie, by June of 1976, Jackie was not comatose anymore. Part of the problem is that during that time, Nat Tarnopol, who became the owner of Brunswick Records, was being prosecuted for payola, for internal revenue tax evasion, and all kinds of other nefarious activities.
Mm-hmm.
And the fear was that if Jackie recovered substantially enough to be able to testify against Nat, that Nat would have gone to prison for years. So, and Nat, it was in Nat's best interest for Jackie to never recover. He had life insurance money, a life insurance policy for $1 million on Jack in 1975, 76. That was a lot of money. and he was directing a lot of traffic and laying money where it, you know, is doing him his the most good over the period of time. And every time Jackie made progress in his therapy, whether it was being able to push himself around in his wheelchair by using his legs and pushing himself backwards after he had had enough physical therapy to start rebuilding the strength in his legs, or whether it was speech therapy, or when Billy Ward came to see Jackie and Jackie actually choked the word out hello in front of the therapist, his speech therapist, and it was documented. Didn't matter, the therapy would be immediately stopped, and with great deliberacy.
Mm-hmm. And you were aware of these stoppages? And I mean, this is something you were seeing happen
there
along the way?
I actually moved. What happened was when Dr. Richardson would go in to treat Jackie at Cherry Hill Medical Center in the evenings, he would call and put the phone next to Jackie's ear, and I would talk to Jackie. And because it would relax him, he recognized my voice. As he was becoming more conscious,
mm-hmm.
he recognized my voice. I would talk to him about stuff, familiar things to him. I'd gossip with him. I'd, you know, just work with him and help him relax and be comfortable with Dr. Richardson, doing this over the phone. And I got a phone call in early June of 1976 from the head nurse at Cherry Hill. And she was sobbing, and she told me that she thought Jackie was losing his will to live. And she begged me to please come back, because the difference between him when I was there or when somebody was there
mm-hmm.
that he knew, that he seemed to care about, and when no one was coming was dramatic, drastic. Mm-hmm. And she really thought he wasn't going to make it if somebody didn't come back there. And my daughter was on, Michelle was on the way to summer camp, and I was in a position to actually do this.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided I was going to spend the 8 weeks that Michelle was at summer camp in New Jersey, bedside with Jack, to see what, you know, what could be done. And I wound up moving to New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
Michelle and I wound up relocating, because it became very clear that he had the capacity to recover, but he had to have somebody there to advocate for him,
right,
and to be an ombudsman and to be the mouth. And that's what I became for
mm-hmm.
A couple of years. The guardian that got appointed was very cooperative. He witnessed my ability to get Jackie to do simple things and follow directions
mm-hmm.
and communicate. We developed a system of being able to communicate both with eye blinks, and Jackie, okay. as he was getting more therapy, was able to go mm-hmm and mm-hmm.
And what would you say, what year is this when he's at this position?
This was 76, 77,
okay.
and the beginning of 78. And as I say, I finally got him into, he was transferred to a nursing facility, and I walked in one day and found him with a black eye. And I found a chair handle from one of those, like, more, not a wheelchair, but one of those, like, day chairs that they put senior citizens in.
Okay.
The chair handle was in his laundry basket in the closet in his room. And I took pictures. I immediately wheeled him over to the window. I have the picture still of him with the black eye and the bruises on his face. And I immediately called the guardian and got Jackie transferred back out of there, back over to Cherry Hill Medical Center long enough to get him situated and finally into a rehab facility in up near Princeton, where he was for about 5 months. And he was starting to make a lot of progress. And when the reports went back to the guardian and the ex-wife, who claimed she was never divorced from him, but there was great reason to believe that they had actually been divorced. But the papers got, you know,
mm-hmm.
doctored, shall we say. Every time that there was any signs and indications that he was making progress, the therapy was stopped, whether it was the speech therapy whether it was the tilt table, whether it was them working with him to strengthen his legs and to get him back to a point where he, because what had happened to him was the motor function got knocked out. He didn't have a heart attack, but one was caused. He had a respiratory failure on the stage at the Latin Casino.
Hmm.
He was transported in the ambulance on September 29th, 1975. Unfortunately, the hospital that they wanted to take him to, they couldn't get to because the Latin Casino was directly across the street from Garden State Racetrack. And at about the time that Jackie collapsed, the track was letting out. And the traffic was so substantial coming out of the racetrack that the ambulance couldn't go in the direction that they wanted to, which was towards Philadelphia, to Cooper Hospital, which was a wonderful hospital, and or they couldn't get to Lourdes, which was the other good hospital in the area. They had to wind up going to Cherry Hill Medical Center, which didn't have the best reputation.
Mm-hmm.
And they got to the hospital. Dick Clark, of course, was it was a Dick Clark show. Dick was in a car trying to follow behind, racing behind in that. When they got Jackie to the hospital, an orderly came and pulled Jackie out of the back of the ambulance. They didn't give, there was no you're supposed to do procedurally, the ambulance team, the paramedics, give the attending physician, the emergency room physician, a status report on the patient, on the condition of the patient that they're transporting. That didn't happen. This orderly, whose name was Jim, took it upon himself with no medical authorization, nothing, to precardial thump Jackie. In other words, he took and balled up his fist and slammed Jackie in the chest, which stopped his heart. From there, they ran him into the emergency room, this orderly did, and they started giving him vasopressors and epinephrine. They shocked him 9 times, and he wound up in a deep coma.
Mm.
And they, of course, claiming that he had a heart attack.
Right.
Here's part of the problem with all of it. If somebody had a heart attack so sufficient to have caused the kind of damage they claimed that it did, why is it that he was never on any heart medication? He didn't have high blood pressure after this incident. He didn't need a valve. He didn't need any valves or any open heart surgery.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't need a heart transplant. He didn't need any of those things. And as I say, he was never on any heart medication.
Right.
And he was never on blood pressure medication because he didn't have high blood pressure.
Right. Well, Joyce, we're going to be running out of time here, and they're going to shut me down. But I know that you could tell me the detail throughout this story, probably until modern day or until he passed it. But what, in the overview of this information for you, what is this? Obviously, like you would imagine, his music legacy is his legacy that's going to remain. But what's at stake here? What's happening in terms of the story?
Well, it's particularly disturbing that in the 40 years since this has happened, other than Van Morrison, Hozier, and the Commodores, none of the people that claim to have been cared about Jackie, which, you know, was the second wife and the guys that own the record label and all, they've done nothing.
Mm-hmm.
There has absolutely been not the only other thing that ever happened was Michael Jackson, who loved and adored Jack,
mm-hmm.
and was a student of Jackie's,
mm-hmm.
dedicated. When Michael got all the Grammys for Thriller, Michael dedicated Thriller and those Grammys to Jackie.
Mm-hmm.
Other than that, there has not been anything done whatsoever to acknowledge the talent and the essence of Jackie Wilson in all of this time.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's certainly one thing, and the other being that the historical record has been he was in a coma for 9 years, or so, you know, which is
absolutely wrong. And the thing about it that's so bad is you think about this in relation to Karen Ann Quinlan, in relation to Terri Schiavo, in relation to all of these, all of this stuff, and the right to die, and there's a right to treatment for and it's tremendously important, because you just never know. Tomorrow morning it could be you, car accident, whatever. Right. And if you know, if what was done to Jackie Wilson could happen to somebody that was famous. None of us are safe. None of us are safe from it.
What's your hope in kind of bringing light to some of these details?
That it maybe saves one other person, or that it helps another family or anyone who's got a situation where they're told that by the doctors that there's no hope for any function recovery, there's no potential for function recovery, there's no, you know, in essence, cutting the person that's in this condition that Jackie was in away from anybody that cares about him, you know, that you don't just go away from it. You hold on and you fight to pull that person back, because the will to live is something that they can't, you know. So it's, I mean, there's so many things, Otto, but
I'll keep looking at your posts too and see, you know, what kind of noise you can make about it and see what kind of a difference it can make. But it's a sad turn of events in terms of historical fact. It's sad to think this is really what happened. You hear things. We heard B.B. King, how he was treated. You have the same issues relating to how people are mistreated. You know, we hear it a lot. There's a lot that goes on. It's unfortunate.
Billy Preston, I mean, the level of the medical malpractice, you know, they bury their mistakes. It's very scary. Yeah. And it's particularly fragile when you don't have the ability to scream and yell, help me, help me.
Exactly.
You know, so
and it's especially sad in Jackie's state where potentially music industry nefarious characters are more interested in your not surviving. Then there's no telling what's really happening when you're not in the room.
Absolutely.
You know, it's tough.
Absolutely.
Well, listen, on a happier note to end the show, before we go, I know that you and Sam still have a bunch coming up. He's headed into more great events this month coming up. You want to give me a quick rundown of what's left for October?
Well, let's see. October 12th is the big birthday, and it is a big birthday. I mean, this is a real milestone, especially in light of, you know, all of our friends and peers that we wish we're still here to celebrate with us and celebrate what's going on.
Right.
And on the 17th, Sam is being inducted into the Smithsonian Memphis Music Hall of Fame, along with Justin Timberlake,
who is
going to be there, and Scotty Moore and Charlie Rich. There's a bunch of posthumous Charlie Rich, Al Jackson Jr., Memphis Slim. There's a few others. And then on the 18th, early in the morning, we fly to Washington, D.C., because Sam has been asked to perform at Kennedy Center at the Mark Twain Awards. This year they're honoring Eddie Murphy. And Sam's the only vocalist so far.
Oh, cool.
And Eddie's favorite song, or one of Eddie's favorite songs, is Hold On, I'm Coming. I just found this out a couple of days ago. So he's doing that, and then we go on Monday. We're taking the Arcella to New York, and Sam is a guest celebrity at the Angel Ball, which celebrates Gabriella Rich, who was Mark and Denise Rich's daughter, who died very young of cancer. And Denise has raised millions of dollars and has actually found some cures to some very specific types and genotypes of cancer through the organization.
Cool.
And then on the next day, we fly to Toronto, because Sam has been asked, this will be the second year that he has been asked to be a featured guest artist at an event called the Dreamcatchers Foundation.
Cool.
For the Indians, the natives, North American Native Indians, are in Canada. And it's a spectacular event, and it honors the the achievements of the Native, which, and it's, I mean, it's cool. Just spectacular.
Great.
Absolutely spectacular. So he's doing that, and he's going to be performing with Native talent.
Cool.
And which is very, very cool. And so that's kind of what we're doing.
All right.
Through the end of October. Aha.
I'm going to have to.
And then
jump
in November.
In November, then in December.
We got this little shindig that I'm kind of putting together and throwing called Salute the Soul Man. And we've got a couple of friends of Sam's, like Sting and Michael McDonald and
Lewis,
and a couple other people coming to roast him, toast him, and sing for him and with him, and honor him and celebrate his legacy.
That's going to be awesome, and that's in November.
November 21st.
All right. Well, listen, thanks for all your time. I know we ran long, and I hope the station doesn't mind posting the whole show, but appreciate all the info, and hopefully people will check
look
into
it. Rambled on. It's
hard to know what details are skipping. You're so close to a story. It's all real. It's all important, you know?
Yep.
So I will talk to you soon. Give my best to Sam,
you,
and we'll check in with Sam as well, and have a great week.
Thank you.
Alrighty.
Thanks, honey. Thanks,
take
Otto.
Care, Joyce. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And thank you for listening to The Otto D. Show. My guest tonight was Pete Cummings, who's off at the Van Halen concert, probably already in the first tune by now, and Joyce Moore. Talk to you next week. Take care.